Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to Adam Blake's new PNEU podcast. As always, this is going to be a conversation with an entity that I am super fond of, a brand in this case that has really guided me into finding niches of cycling that I just supremely enjoy. Passively and actively at times, this brand has supported me professionally and personally too. I'm just like so excited right now. It might be the coffee, but I'm pretty excited. With Kid, Miker, Lindsay, and Pete from Salsa Cycles. Thank you guys for being here. Thank you for the time. Just, you know, right off the bat, I really appreciate the opportunity to get to sit with you guys and hopefully continue to impress upon you my fondness of what you guys do because it's immense.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Yeah, man. And so, you know, I said this to you guys off the mics. I think that a very unique thing besides offerings and this and that with Salsa is the mentality of adventure by bike. And I don't want to diminish that by calling it a tagline or a gimmick. To me, it's more of like a mantra kind of thing, something that's really filled with belief and stuff like that versus, you know, this is the feel of speed or something that's kind of abstract. Sure. You know, people can gravitate to the concept of adventure on a bicycle, right? Yeah. It's like tangible. It didn't always exist in Salsa, though. Adventure by bike was not at the inception of Salsa. There was some offerings and some really pretty wild offerings at times in the road market and other things. Miker, you're probably the most tenured Salsa-ish employee that I'm aware of, at least, that's currently still enrolled, you know, with the brand.
I am.
That's what I thought. It's a good thing, man. I appreciate it. Can you tell us where the concept of adventure by bike came about, when it came about, and now maybe you can all enlighten us to how that directs product development, marketing representation, all this framing things, because it's unlike any other brand in the industry, in my opinion.
Sure. So clearly, there was a different version of Salsa, right? And I'm not going to do this whole history, right?
Sure.
But, like, Salsa was founded in 82 out in California by Ross Schaefer.
Ross Schaefer. Okay.
They primarily, at that time, were famous for steel stems. That was the biggie. Quick release skewers, flip-off skewers, seat collars. And they did make frames, three different kinds of frames, a mountain frame, a cross frame, and a road frame, steel. And they were made in Petaluma. And I think they were making something like 200 frames a year. So I say that number just to put it in context. You're talking about a fairly small business.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the reasons, but at some point Ross decided he wanted to sell Salsa. And he approached, my understanding of it is, he approached Steve Flagg and Mary Henriksen, Steve's wife, about purchasing it. And eventually that did happen. That was 1996. And things stayed actually out in Petaluma for a bit, maybe a year and a half or so. And then it essentially moved here, and production of various things moved overseas. Actually, I screwed that up. We actually did try to produce those frames stateside here for a few more years. Waterloo, Waterford. They did it for a while, and then there was a Twin Cities brand called Kroll, C-R-O-L-L,
okay.
And the owner of that was a guy named Frank Amore. They produced our steel frames for a while, too. In the end, cost being the biggest driver, they moved overseas. What happens after that is kind of where, I guess I'll say, like you referred to sort of it getting a little crazy. It got a little crazy. maybe people will call it a little Western. Okay.
Sure.
So I think about it as being the years of experimentation.
Sure.
And we created a lot of product that maybe didn't have that much rhyme or reason as to them, but it was sort of, we can. So there was a sunglass line, Salsa Soul, S-O-L, sunglass line. There was, you know, sports bras. There was just a whole bunch of stuff as we sort of found our way. There were eventually Scandium bike frames. And there's people still riding those Scandium bikes out there. Hey, more power to you. Glad you're still enjoying them. But the reality is, if I just have to sum sort of that phase up, was I don't think we were really bringing much of anything special to the market at that time. Maybe the Dose Niner being an exception.
My first real cross-country race bike, loved the Dose Niner. Absolutely loved it.
Dose was one of those Scandium frames, Relish Shock.
Yep.
Just an inch of travel in the rear. Yep. 29er, early on the 29er game. But let's be serious, the other bikes were kind of like what most of the rest of the industry is offering.
Right.
That sort of, that experiment went on for a while. Then I guess I kind of almost wish I knew what the day was. I don't really know what the day is, but Jason Boucher was the brand manager and I was doing the marketing. And one day, I give Jason really full credit for this because I always say it's a super bold thing. He basically got a few of us in a room and said, what if we wipe the slate clean and start it over? What would we want Salsa to be? And if you actually just step back in any business and think about sort of that, that's a big thing.
Big deal.
Right? Like, wait a minute. Like, let history go.
Right.
Like, reconsider entirely. But that's what we did.
Yeah.
And we wound up sitting in a conference room downstairs. There was multiple meetings. It's not like this just kind of just happened overnight, but in some ways it still did happen overnight. Like, we got to those three words, adventure by bike, pretty quick, actually.
Sure.
In fact, we tried to find other words and couldn't get past those right. three words. Like, it just kind of kept coming back. We were like, we're not saying it better.
Right.
We're not saying it better. And those three words came about because we sat in this room and all of us had, I would say, quite diverse cycling experiences in our lives, from growing up to as young adults or not that young adults. So we had like this giant range of thing where, you know, I never raced cyclocross, but somebody did, right? Big bike tours, fat biking. And just in the end, we sort of talk about all of these experiences and got to the bottom line of it's what we really remember of those experiences was the adventures of having those experiences and much less so the bike you happen to do it on.
Sure.
Like it's an interesting exercise that a lot of your listeners should try to do. I've done it a little bit lately. You sit at your computer and you try to think of every bike you've owned.
I did not do that.
Try to find a picture of, not the exact one you owned, but like, and it's kind of fun, but in the end, you sort of see that you had this big, giant collection of bikes that changed all the time, and maybe you probably did like some more than others. For sure, you'd actually like some more than others, but you really have the fondness for the experiences that you did with those things. That's sort of really how we got there, and maybe there's some coincidences or good fortune in timing. Joe Miser, he really wasn't our, I don't think he really was called our product manager at the time. He was just like our engineer. But he was planning to do the Tour Divide. Both Jason and I had, at former times, had drop bar mountain bikes. Bless you, John Tomac.
Right.
For like, let's be serious.
Yep. Right.
Where'd that idea come from? Okay, Johnny T. Mine was a Bridgestone.
Yep.
Had a suspension fork on the front. Did a Moab trip with it once. Basically scared myself to death.
Yep.
Because it was not designed as a drop bar mountain bike. So the stem was too long.
Right.
You know. But we had all these experiences, and they lead us to those words. Joe was thinking about doing the Tour Divide. We wind up saying, what would be the best bike to do the Tour Divide on?
Yep.
Oh, 29er.
Yep.
Drop our 29er for hand positions.
Probably so.
Right? And the Fargo starts to take shape.
That was actually the first bike I worked on.
Blew my mind when that bike came out. Aesthetically, super fungi green, first one, right?
Yeah.
Super, super cool. You got on that bike, and you're like, this is nothing that... Because, yeah, I dabbled. Monster Cross was maybe being dabbled in by people, you know, trying to fit big tires and cross frames and this and that, you know. And certain niches weren't super established, so you had a little more tire wiggle room. UCI limitations and cross bikes didn't exist and stuff like that. But when that bike came out, I remember getting on one and being like, I could ride like anything I wanted on this bike, right? You know, I could do anything on this bike. This is crazy to me, and it feels good. It doesn't feel like any of my experiments, which aesthetically, it maybe mimicked some of my experiences, but it didn't function, or the characteristics of that bike were not concurrent with my experiments.
Yeah, and there will be no secrets given away here, but yesterday and today we might have talked about the next Fargo a little bit.
Yeah, let's keep them wanting more, right?
So, anyway, in the end, you wind up with it shaping the brand to a point in a way that we were willing to look at. You use the word niches, I'll agree. We were willing to maybe look at those niches and find some that we don't just make them if we don't believe in them.
Right.
But if we believe that they deserve to exist, let's bring them to market, because there's a market for these. It might not be as giant
yet
sized. Yeah. Or ever.
Or ever.
But if there's enough of a range of people that want it, you can serve them, and you can give them, let's be serious, the best tool for their job.
Right? Oh, yeah, most definitely.
So as crazy at the time as a drop bar 29er sounds, I mean, well, heck, we have more than one of them now.
Right, right. It's like my favorite platform of bike.
And there's clearly a market for them.
Agreed.
Now, don't all the brands listening to this believe they all have to be in that market? Because that isn't the case.
Right.
I mean, actually, I think you're going to get to at some point talking about fat bikes here.
Right.
And that actually maybe is sort of something that happened in fat bikes, where brands start to think other brands, like the getting's too good.
Right, right. We got to get a piece of the pie.
But the reality is, if we're going to be honest at all, cycling is about niches.
Sure.
And in my opinion, the best thing you can do is to try to make that tool that serves those better than another tool.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, as a mechanic, you know, the right tool for the job is prevalent every day. I mean, I have a pedal wrench tattooed on my leg. It's just a 15-millimeter wrench. But, like, if you need to get a pedal off, the pedal wrench is the best tool for the job. And, yep. And that's kind of what I believe in, and I think that's akin to what you're saying. Yeah, Fargo, just kind of crazy how that came about. So another one, you know, when we talk about niches, and that's more apparent that now than ever, right? We have distinctive niches, that bikes that to the untrained eye look almost identical, but in ride characteristics and intention and stuff, they're They're vehemently different. They're totally different in how they perform. One of them that didn't look like anything as we were establishing the niche was a fat bike. Surly kind of brought it into the lower 48. Not kind of. They definitely did with the Purple Pugsley first. And I believe Gray Pugsley also existed. Some guys in Alaska maybe were lacing rims together and kind of sewing tires together and stuff. And but the Muckluck, aluminum, some different things. We've got Pete here who does some designing, I guess I would say. Is that the best word to describe what your impact on fat bikes is?
I'm one of the product development engineers.
Product development engineer.
Pete basically has done all our fat bikes.
Right, pretty much the fat bikes. So you're welcome, everybody. Yeah. You're welcome for Pete.
It's a team effort.
Thank you, Pete.
Yeah, right. Let's give Pete credit. You're in the room. Let's give you the credit. Let's kind of talk about fat bikes. We're on fatbike.com. Original Muckluck, wonderful platform, had some limitations. Always we see progression in fat bikes, even now that the market's a little more flooded. You know, we're seeing brands that have really adhered to the fat bike, like Salsa have, and although there's not very many of them that are as dedicated, in my opinion. Continue to progress fat bikes with utilization of materials, geometric refinements, now component functions. I put a dropper on my Bear Grease. It's the best dropper install I've ever done. Good and idea. I thank you.
Yeah.
It was the best dropper install I've ever done. Slid right in, came right out. So easy.
And very handy.
Oh, I know. I was talking about it with Ben Witt. I was such a dropper naysayer because I'm kind of older in biking. And I was like, you know, just put your belly button on the saddle, get your butt back, you'll be fine. And then I put a dropper on my fat bike, and I'm like, damn, this is like the best thing. Yeah. And I could talk about droppers for a long time, too. Their usage. My wife has totally different usages for her dropper than I do. Hers is more about getting on and off the bike, especially in snow when she sinks, you know. Starting and stopping is the hardest thing for her, not riding, you know. So it's wild that they're as adaptable as they are. Pete, maybe chime in a little bit on some of those things that, you know, the development, the continued tailoring. Maybe you don't have to worry about dropper routing so much, though I do. Tire sizes even, I guess, that we could talk about. And how Salsa got to play with implementation also of new tires, and how do we accentuate new tires as more companies have got on board? How do we accentuate new materials as other things? And, you know, and Lindsay, just, you know, chime in any time on some of this stuff, because we're still educating people about fat bikes. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's been 2009 was original Muckluck, is that right, or 10?
I think it was actually 11.
11? 11 was Muckluck, so 9 years of Mucklucks and Bear Greases? Or not always Bear Grease, but
I think it's 2010, but
I thought it was 10 too, but it doesn't really matter. Let's say 10 years of fat bikes. We're still educating people that they, A, exist, and B, how to utilize them. So as Pete kind of tells us how they're going and how maybe he envisions them going, I would love for you to chime in about how we're continually telling the story, in particular of using fat bikes to elongate seasons, to spend more time on bikes, to adventure by bike more. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a big thing that we talked about with 45 North when I got the chance to sit down with them. The Wolfhammer opened up so many doors for me. Mm-hmm. Pretty much previous to the Wolfhammer, I rode until my feet were ice, and then I would go home, or go home hopefully in a concurrent time. But then the Wolfhammer came and blew the doors off of everything for me, you know. I got to stay out for hours at that point comfortably and safely, you know. So, Pete, maybe take me through just progression of fat bikes, you know, Bear Grease, big deal in my opinion, and the first carbon fat right?
Yep.
Walk us kind of through that lineage of fat.
Well, it, you know, we got to give the nod to Surly because they started it, and we were all riding Surlys.
Yep.
Out of this building.
Yep.
And back in the early days.
And I'm going to even insert, no offense to the Alaskans.
Right. I totally understand.
But, like,
they got to sometimes lighten up a little bit on, like, that rim and that tire from Surly were so important.
So important.
It was really the first time anybody got to move past the cobbling stuff together.
Right. It was viable out of the box.
Yeah, bringing to the masses.
Right, to the masses. And numbers don't lie, right? Yeah, there was X amount of a pocket of people dabbling in those things. But when the Pugsley hit, I remember building a purple one, and it was like a 20 or something, 22 maybe even at that. I don't know if that existed at that point. Big, tall guy. And I'm like, stupid bike. Why am I working on this big old heavy stupid bike? And then I had to test ride a bike that's at least two sizes too big for me. And within about 5 minutes, I was like, oh my God, I need this bike. Yeah. Like, this is the best thing I've ever been on. And this doesn't even fit me.
We were all kind of in the same
just blown boat. Away.
And we knew we had an opportunity at Salsa because we weren't Surly. We could do something different, do something else, not to try to compete, but to try to offer, especially out of this building, right, to try to offer some choice.
Surly more associated with steel, original aluminate. Mukla came in aluminum.
Yep.
You know, so some differences that were afforded to you maybe.
Yeah. So, and that really was, it was actually Joe Miser and Mike are here were, that the first Mukla was all them. I just said, okay, this is what you guys want. And I put all the tubes together, did the drawings, sent it off. Boom, frame comes back.
I like to say I might have had too much to do with it.
Yeah. Appreciate everybody's.
I'd been drawing. I mean, I'm not an engineer, which everyone already knew, but I'm not. I'll say it again. I am not an engineer. I had taken a picture of my drop bar Fargo.
Yeah.
And I my Pugsley, and I took pictures of them next to each other. I was doing my math and going to order a custom titanium fat bike, which I'm divorced now. It would have happened sooner had that actually. Thankfully, the place I called didn't answer the phone.
Right.
Literally.
Keep a trouble if you
pursue that. Or return
that.
My phone call. Ever. But the day that I made that call was the day we got told we could make one.
It's awesome.
Because we'd been wanting to. But the building had been slowing down our ability. And we finally got permission to make the mug.
Yeah, so we did that. And I will wholeheartedly agree with Miker. It was definitely Miker had a lot of influence on it. If we're being honest, I was not a fan of the first mug.
It kind of, you know, it was what it was, right? Yeah. Now, knowing what we and know now.
It was so early in the fat bike days.
Right.
Everybody was just throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks, right, and what works and what doesn't. And it was a really awesome time, because how often do you get to, as a product designer, enter a completely new market,
right,
and develop product from the ground up versus like, okay, well, this is, you know, I mean, the cycling industry, bikes are bikes, but we've talked, they're all niches. But really, you know, a lot of times, like a road bike, like it's, everybody's trying to innovate and create the new Bex road bike, but you're building on what's been done.
Right.
And yeah, there was a little bit of a base for fat bikes, but it was so new. It was just blue ocean. Right. So it was a really exciting time to be doing that stuff. And we did that first Mukluk. We learned a ton. We started making, you know, more geo proto samples, because now we had a base of a frame we could work with, and started refining things. And then at the same time, you know, tires and rims are taking off. And one of the biggest hurdles in the early fat bike days was cranks.
Yeah, right.
You know, you had to find 100 mil square taper cranks or ISIS cranks, and they're just, it's all triples, and we were still in the 3x2. You know, 2x wasn't even actually an official thing. We were just running triples truncated down to 2x, and you had this front derailleur. And really, you got to give credit to the people over in Chicago and in the SRAM crew. What they did with first with the XX, the 2x stuff, it changed the form of the front derailleur.
Mm-hmm.
And it created clearance not only for fat bikes, but for 29ers. And you really started seeing chainstay lengths come down to lengths that started to make these new different bikes ride more like the mountain bikes that they were being compared against. And then you extrapolate that out to the advent of 1x, it just completely changed the game. You know, and that's several years I'm skipping over there, but that whole progression really made a big difference. And then at the same time, this fat bike stuff was blowing up, and they're talking to us about it from an OE perspective, and we're talking about cranks. And then eventually, you know, I remember it specifically. I actually still have the XX1 carbon fat bike crank that SRAM delivered to us, hand delivered to Frostbike the year we showed Bear Grease Carbon in the back room. That was the only fat bike crank that we knew of, or, you know, I'm sure SRAM had a few, but like that was the only one that had gone outside their building at that point that we had. I still have that crank. I'm still riding that crank today. It's actually on my current Mukluk.
It's awesome.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. And that, to have that OE crank option, a legitimate crank option, well, that really changed the game as well. So it's, you add the 1x2x stuff in, that really changed the game. And then at the same time, Surly's innovating with tires, and 45 North is there, and everybody's doing tires, there's rims happening, whiskey rims come into play. And then meanwhile, that's influencing the rest of the industry, and the rest of the industry is piling on, trying to get a piece of the action. So like the advancements in technology from everybody, from components and options, was like, it was pretty cool. So you're like stuck in the middle of that developing frames, and it's like you could just develop a frame and then turn around and start developing the next one because everything was already obsolete.
Right.
There's already new, better stuff.
That's crazy. Yeah, I can imagine that. As I think about, you know, us at World of Bikes in Iowa City, we supported the original Mukluk. We sold, I think, 12 that year, which, like, was pretty crazy to us, you know, 12 of this bike, you know. And Larry Tire also came along with, at the same time at least, which was pretty big improvement in steering over the previous endomorph, I always thought. But, you know, it is funny to think, like, what you kind of talked about, like, blank slate, right? No expectations, right? I'm not comparing this to anything. And all the early comparisons to mountain bikes and things that existed, it was like, yeah, I mean, you can ride it off-road, but not really the same thing, right? Tire, you know, twice the tire, can't expect it to be the same thing in just width, you know?
But everything develops.
Right.
So it's like the tires take a different shape, you know, like that endomorph tire. Yeah, I know there's people actually in certain places that love that tire because for where they ride, it's the greatest thing.
It's a good sand tire.
Sure. But, like, just there's so many just tiny little improvements that are all coming together to wind up refining a machine.
I think the biggest one from my world of my little corner of being involved in fat bikes was Bear Grease Carbon was not monumental in the way that maybe the public understands it being monumental. It was from my perspective where I sit, it was like earth shattering because we knew we were developing that. Uncle Steve Flagg, the owner, we call him Uncle Steve.
Yep.
He basically came and was like, hey, we want you to do that. We want you to make a carbon bike. It was actually, I think, the first carbon bike QBP had done or was going to do.
Yeah.
So not only was it the first carbon fat bike, but for QBP it was a big deal because it was the first carbon bike we developed ourselves. But I was like, we can't open tens of thousands of dollars of tooling, big steel blocks, and get it wrong.
Right.
So it was really cool because I made a bunch of geo samples of different geos because I had these ideas rattling around my head about, like, how can we improve these fat bikes and make them better, make them ride more like a mountain bike, which turned out to, in the end, be like, hey, yeah, this works for these too. It doesn't have to be quite this different thing. It can be, but it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
And so made these geo protos, and I'm riding around at the trail on what looks like a Mukluk with alternator dropouts. And people are like, oh, what's that? I'm like, oh, it's just an old Mukluk proto. Yeah. Nobody bats an eye. Really, it was like, I couldn't tell them, like, you guys have no idea what I'm riding right now. It is awesome compared to what you're riding.
Yeah. I remember two, like, anecdotal stories. I remember being at Frostbike that year, and somehow, I'll blame Jason. He chirped in my ear. He's like, you are into what's coming. And I'm like, oh, God, please be a carbon fat bike. Yeah. No basis. I didn't even know if it was a real hope. And we sat down in that room, and not only was it a carbon fat bike, but it was an XX1 equipped carbon fat bike at that point. And I'm like almost feeling like I'm going to be in tears. I'm so excited about that bike. You know, I'm just like, holy cow, this is it right here, right? We existed in fat bikes, and now from here, it was like validation to me. Kind of like what you said, because I was aware of the investment in toolings and all this stuff. So if somebody at Q or Salsa or whoever felt that strongly about this, this is where we are going, you know? And I was just like blown away. And I had an original one, and it one of my personal favorite bikes that I've ever owned.
Yeah, Lindsay, when did we introduce the latest Bear Grease?
It was in September or July. Sorry.
Was it the 19 model? 18 model?
No, it was last year.
Yeah, 19 went to 27.5.
Yep, it was.
Or 19, however we call model years anymore.
So that bike that I developed, that I was riding around in his aluminum proto, and actually, funny story, gave that to Jason and said, here, just ride this. And he's like, what is it? And I was like, just go ride it. And he took it for the weekend and came back, and he's like, I see what you did there.
Yeah.
You could see the glow in his eyes, like, oh, my God, this is a completely different experience. So then that set the stage for what became the original Bear Grease. And up until we introduced the latest model that we're on now, that Bear Grease remained unchanged.
Yeah, this is and V2.
Yeah, that was V2. V1. Yeah, I'm not. A little bit of it was like luck, and a little bit of it was like being calculated. But to have a bike that runs, what would that have been? I think the original one came out in 13.
Yeah.
So I was working on Geo for that probably in 2011.
Right.
2011-12 winter season. That had a nearly 7 or 8 year run.
Right.
And it was still relevant when we took it out of the market and put the new one in.
Still is.
It's still
is. Oh, yeah.
So like to nail that bike that many years ago and still have it be relevant today is like unheard of. Like,
oh, yeah.
The way things progress typically after, you know, a bike will run 3-4 years and then it's on to the next one. And so, however, the group, you know, and again, it wasn't just me, there was a whole bunch of people that were involved in that. But like, it was so cool how that bike was so relevant, not only when so progressive when it came out, but then stayed so relevant for so long.
And I think that how progressive it was almost got masked a little just because it was made out of carbon fiber. Like,
agreed.
The carbon fiber things, you could just see it with your eyes.
Right.
So that sort of gets, like, lots of the attention, mm-hmm. whereas what you don't see with your eyes is how something rides.
And by and large, the latest iteration we're on, it's the guts of it are pretty much the same bike. There's just some subtle refinement to tire clearance and fit because we have all these new tire options and 27.5 is a thing. But the base kind of Geo and everything is like pretty much rooted in the OG Bear Grease. Like, it still hasn't changed.
Well, and that's what drives product development is like to go back to adventure. Adventure is such a buzzword, right? And when we started talking about adventure, no other cycling companies were talking about adventure. But really what that is for us is it's about the feeling that you get. And so that's why we're omni-material, and that's why we focus on offering multiple wheel sizes. You know, whether the rider only rides a fat bike and that's their only bike and they ride it year-round on dirt, or they ride it in the wintertime and they ride their mountain bike in the summer, you know, it's about getting people out on new terrain, experiencing new things, and really expanding the opportunity for adventure with all of these choices.
Right.
We're really in an industry of choice.
Choice, right. I've talked about that in every interview. It's like, nobody has to come see me at the bike shop, right? Like, don't have to. They're making a choice that they want to progress in cycling or whatever. Two things I want to touch on. You mentioned the guts of the Bear Grease. So I'm on my third Bear Grease. I have a 2019 GX Eagle, the tennis ball white paint job. So dialed. Love that bike. But I also had an original Bear Grease, and I had a pink and orange fade Bear Grease. Mm. Pretty primo. When I got on the 27.5 in 2019, obviously I noticed certain characteristic differences. But what I loved about, I took time off in between them all too. It wasn't like one to the next just from aesthetics. What I loved when I got on my pink and orange, it felt just like my original bear grease, because it was. Mm-hmm. When I got on this one, it didn't feel exactly, but it felt like a bear grease. You know, the bear grease rides like a bear grease, right? I've gotten an opportunity to ride a lot of fat bikes, and bear grease has an identity that it is what it is. It rides like what it does. Yeah, would you agree with that?
No, it is. The Geo remained largely unchanged. The difference was the choice of the wheel spec.
Right.
And really, there isn't – it's not like we set out and said, we're going to make a dedicated 27.5 fat bike, which you could do. It's valid. We, for all of our experience, collective experience, we don't really see whole 27.5 by whatever is better than 26. It's like, no, it's a choice.
Right.
Back to what Lindsay was talking about. It's like offering choice. And we can offer that versatility and that choice without – having to make too many sacrifices there in terms of optimizing the frame design. So we're like, well, we're not going to push bear grease to be just 27.5, even though maybe that's how we spec it. It still works great with 26 inch tires. And so by and large, the Geo is pretty much the same trail. All that stuff stays the same. The philosophy of like, we're going to put this big old cannon of a down tube on there, like a road racing bike. Like it's super stiff down from the head tube down across the bottom side. It's super stiff and responsive, and that's what makes a bear grease, and that's what fundamentally makes the Muckluck different. You're like, well, why do you have two carbon fat bikes? Uh-huh. Well, guess what? The Muckluck actually has more frame compliance. There's more BB sway in a Muckluck than there is in a bear grease, and that's because the bear grease is our racing fat bike. It's a rocket ship.
Right.
It's designed for people to do these winter ultras and even two-hour local races. Mm-hmm. And be fast.
We have riders show up all the time and tell us that they show up to a race with two wheel sets, and they wait, and they pre-ride the course, and sometimes they might make a last-minute decision to run 26, depending on course conditions.
Yeah, maybe.
Or they might say, it's going to be really fast rolling, I'm going to stick with the 27.5. So, and you'll see that across all of our product decisions, that we, you know, beyond fat, make that an intentional decision in product development.
Yeah. It's kind of one of the, I think, fat bikes. I mean, it was an excellent training ground, and it's your world, for Plus.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, because in the end, it's all about fitting things into space.
Right.
And the constraints that come with each different component.
I remember sitting at a SRAM OE camp and they were explaining what Boost 148 was to us, you know, like spending a lot of time like, okay, it's this and the chain ring moves out and we're like, so it's just kind of like skinny fat bikes, right? And they're like, and I was like, we've been doing this for like 6 or 7 years. We got it.
We got this under control.
Pete's pretty humble. Before Super Boost existed, Pete was trying to get us to make a Super Boost bike because he's like, this is what it should have been, is this rear spacing is really where it should have gone. But no hubs or anything existed yet.
Well, we had the downhill hub.
Yeah, 157 existed in a realm in downhill with 83 BBs usually, right?
There's nothing wrong with
it. And heavy cranks.
Boost 148's great. It's done a lot of good things for bikes, but it was actually that same meeting when we were finding out about this Boost 148 stuff. It was Miser and I had we still have them. We actually talked about them today before, like unbeknownst to this interview. Like Miser has this old titanium 29er built around a 150 rear end because we wanted to see how short we could get the chainstays and still clear a 29x25.
Just for fun.
It was just a project. And then I created a steel hardtail. It wasn't a mariachi. But it was.
Yeah. So calm down, everybody.
Right. But it's a mariachi. Stop it. I know. Great bike. Loved it. Stop.
It was pre All City Log Lady, maybe. Uh-huh. Pre Karate Monkey Instigator. We were like, and it was a 157 bike, and we called it the three-wheeler because it fit 29x25, it fit 27.5x30, and it fit 26x38 on a narrow rim, all in a 157 back end with a 420, four chainstay or something like that.
Pretty short.
Yeah, and it had alternator dropouts. You needed to use those for the, I think, for the fat bike.
Right.
But it was a 157 bike because you could use a 29-inch wheel, you could do a 2.5 tire, and you could get super short chainstays. And then Boost came around and said, oh, we're going to do that with this Boost. And I'm like, well, we kind of went halfway there.
Yeah, you're getting there.
We could have gone all the way and just said, hey, we got these 150 hubs from downhill and these cranks. If we just push some lighter spindles in these cranks and make things lighter, like we could achieve the same thing. But, you know, that was outside of our control, and there's bigger factors that push that down. So it's like, great. But now fast forward several more years and Super Boost is a thing.
A thing.
And, you know, when we heard, we'd always been on it. We just didn't have the means to do it. And then when we heard, you know, Pivot had mentioned it to us in passing at one point and a few, and we're like, we started to hear rumblings and we're like, yeah, that it does make a lot of sense. Like the math where you can't fit more than, you know, one thing in space there. And they all got to clear on that bottom bracket shell. So when we heard from Pivot that they were talking about doing it for their first Switchblade, we're like, yeah, we're already working on it for, it was at the time for Horse Thief. Like, like I can't fit a 2.6 and a 32 tooth ring and my chainstay length that we want. All in that space. So what's got to give? And the answer was, well, if we use Super Boost, nothing has to give. So it's like, well, okay, either stick with 148 and make your chainstays longer, drop down in your ring size, or kill your tire size. Or just go with Super Boost and keep all three. It's like, it's a pretty easy answer.
So for all you Super Boost haters, here's why.
It does make, and
validated by Pete.
Well, and then take it another detail deeper. Fat bikes were, there was 4-inch and there was 5-inch for a while. Surly started pushing the 5-inch stuff and was like, this is amazing. But it was a really wide Q factor and a really wide chain line because you had to get around that extra tire. And we actually, you remember, we had a Blackboro. The first Blackboro was basically a wider version of our Muckluck. And that was because at the time we fundamentally believed that, we didn't believe, facts stated that if you wanted to get the chain around that big of a tire and use your full cassette, you needed a wider chain line.
Right, because we were truncating cassettes and stuff to kind of fit bigger tires.
So we didn't want to do that. And but then that meant your Q factor was really wide. And then, and this is credit to someone else because it wasn't us that figured it out, but they said, well, what if we took the standard 100 mil, you know, SRAM offering crank and we put a dished ring on it? You know, and you get the chain line of the 5-inch chain line, but you get the Q factor of the 4-inch. And it was like, So that's why the Blackboro was so short-lived. It's like, oh, well, we can just
new
get this out of
new things came to light,
You know, new stuff came to light. And so, full story, back to what we were talking about with the Super Boost thing. The Super Boost is, it employs the same ideas. It's you take a, you can take a standard crank arm. In fact, this is what I pitched to SRAM when I was originally like, hey, we want to do this Super Boost instead of Boost, was take your standard Boost arms, which are actually standard 142 arms, right? It's mountain chain line. And instead of putting the Boost ring on it, you put your zero offset ring that they have for, it was, I think at the time, their BB30 cranks. And that pushes the chain line out to 55. So you can set up a, like the Horse Thief today, you can set up with a 32 tooth zero offset ring on a SRAM crank, you can set up a 55 chain line and still run that 157 back end. Whereas the, there's a Super Boost crank, OE crank option from SRAM that has a little bit wider spindle, so they didn't have to make an extra chain ring. So you kind of, you can pick between the two.
And obviously, you know, I think the Super Boost thing is really, I think all of this is really pretty money as far as Super Boost and viability. But one buy, not to get into it too much, probably made that more accessible because we're only offsetting a ring versus like multiple rings and front derailleur mounts being pushed out and this and that. One buy kind of probably.
One buy opened
like, up doors.
We were talking about earlier, like the whole fat bike design.
You can just do things now that we've extended the range of cassettes.
For everybody that can't see, the best thing is the Pete's just spouting all this out straight out of his brain without any notes.
Yeah, this is no notes
also,
or anything.
He looks very, very happy.
Yeah.
That's the best part.
Yeah, super happy.
Super pleased.
I love talking about the nitty-gritty and the details.
Oh, yeah, and that's it's in the details, right? Yeah. That's like frivolous alterations of bikes I'm not really into, right? You know, like just to change. But like when you can make advantages or performance-based upgrades, let's say, or versatility maybe to add value to a bike because it's wheel sizes or this or that, that's really important, I think, because bikes are more expensive than they've ever been, and people maybe are, even though there's all these niches, you know, they don't have as many bikes maybe. So having a bike that can support maybe multiple wheel sizes, that's pretty important because wheels are still an upgrade, but it's not as much as a whole nother bike.
Well, and we live it here too. I mean, I think our advantage, especially with fat bikes, not only being at the ground floor, is we live in an area that has a pretty solid winter, and we typically get enough snow. But our weather, you know, like you can be in areas like out west, like, you know, in the Jackson area, there's a lot of good fat biking there, but they get just hammered with snow. Or even up in Marquette, Michigan, they're amazing fat biking up there, but like a lot of times they're struggling with keeping just a trail open to ride.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then you go in other areas and it's just like they maybe don't even get snow, or they'll get a little bit of snow and it'll melt or turn to ice in a couple of days. We're like, we really have this advantage here where like we get snow and trails will set up and we can have amazing conditions for weeks at a time.
Yeah, there's kind of a sweet spot.
Yeah. And then, but then we also get these freestyle cycles right now where we haven't had snow for a few weeks, and then we had a really warm weekend, so now the trails are more icy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that actually like plays into an advantage for us because that we're sitting here, we can't get away from it except for maybe a week at a time if you go on vacation. But so you have things like studded tire development happens because like we get a really icy winter.
Right.
You know, and having all these different bikes, we're like, well, I'm going to ride this, you know, 26 with some super knobbies because it's super loose today, but then in 5 days all the trails are gonna be packed in, and we're gonna try this 27.5x4 thing and see how that goes. And you know, we got, you know, guys sponsored team riders up running Arrowheads, and you know
what wheel did Neil run?
He ended up running 27.5, but he brought both wheels.
He did run 27.5.
Yep.
Wow, that was a wonderful event and a wonderful accomplishment. Yeah. I mentioned it to him on his social media.
To Pete's point, though, like, I lived out west for a while, and it's such a change to be here. We're riding fat bikes on snow like mountain bikes. Right. I mean, I had never had a winter before where I felt like I was trail riding year-round, just on a different surface.
Right.
And so Bear Grease is at home in that environment here, you know, but then in turn you go up north to International Falls or anywhere in the Northwoods, and you're riding snowmobile trail for a long period of time, and Muckluck is a little bit more at home there, depending on snow conditions.
Sure.
But yeah, you get, you know, Muckluck, you can pull that dropout back, get a longer wheelbase, you put big 5-inch, 26-inch tires on it,
right,
drop them way, way down, and you can just cruise on straight snowmobile trail.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Whereas, like, when we're riding Bear Grease around here,
with droppers,
it's like, yeah, you drop, you like, it, you...
You're mountain biking.
I don't know if anybody watches Supercross, but you know those guys, you'll see them sit on the seat and stick their foot out on the inside and just hammer corners.
That's like what Pete looks like.
We do that. We literally do that at 4 miles an hour.
Right.
And it's awesome. And where else can you two-wheel drift and not worry about exploding and being able to pick yourself up off the ground because you're two-wheel drifting at maybe 4 to 6 miles an hour. On 4-inch tires, and there's a couple feet of snow. Whereas, like, if you got into if you were going fast enough and cornering hard enough on a regular mountain bike on dry trail to go into a two-wheel drift, if you mess up, you're done.
Like, yeah, right.
You're not getting back up.
Yeah.
So fat biking is so fun because I was just out the other weekend riding, and there's this little chute thing, and I went down that chute, and first turn, second turn, third turn, and I came out the fourth turn and just wadded up. You know, just fully over the bars, full of snow all down my back, and there's two people up at the top, and the guy's like, "You okay?" I was like, "Yeah, man, you might as well push it. The landings are soft."
Yeah.
So you can actually, like, I love it because you can ride the bike and you can throw the bike around in ways that you can't that only the pros can do.
Right.
You know, the 1% athletes that you see in the magazines and the movies. But you as a regular average Joe or Jane can do that on a fat bike in the snow at such a slow speed with such a soft landing. It's like you can feel like you can you develop bike handling skills. And every spring when I get back on my regular mountain bike, I feel like a champ because I've been so used to being loose and open with my hips and my knees and throwing the bike around and being squirrely that once you get some good traction on a full sus bike on a trail, you're just like, you feel like a rock star.
It's like you're practicing, you're keeping up all winter long.
Yep. To what Lindsay said, it really is, we are trail riding on just a different surface all year round here.
Yeah. And the rocks tend to be buried, so then that's the thing you got to remember in the springtime.
Yeah. We support a Friday night fat bike ride at World of Bikes. It's been about 10 years or so old. I mean, since first Muckluck, you know, the small group, and it's grown. But I'm always talking about this skill set development, right? Like, if you can do all this stuff, and we're stomping around, bushwhacking, that kind of stuff. If you can do this here at slow speed, when speed increases, you can still do this, you know. But this is the way to develop that skill set, in my opinion, just based on how I was brought up in mountain biking.
And because of all this, fat bikes aren't going anywhere.
Not at all.
You know, like, we might not be having every single brand coming out with a new fat bike every year, but they're not going anywhere. There's a use for them. There are people who continue, again, industry of choice, to choose fat bikes again and again. And that's not going to change.
I would say that even people are, sorry, Mike, but people are even increasing. I know more people who are exclusive fat bikers now, thanks to people like Pete and the development of these fat bikes in a lot of brands. But, you know, that's all. They gravel ride on fat bikes. They mountain bike on a fat bike. Yep. They snow ride on a fat bike. I know guys that have fat bikes that don't even ride in snow.
Sure.
Totally.
Ever, you know? Sure. And it's like, all right, man.
Hello, Florida.
Right. Blew my mind, though, when I first heard it just coming from Iowa. And, you know, the initial impetus was get on snow and stuff like that.
But the bottom line is fat bikes can go places other bikes can't.
100%.
And that's not just marketing.
No, that's fact.
That's just the reality.
Yep.
Right. Ride through three-foot-tall grass on any other bike for more than 5 feet.
Or a sandy wash in Utah. Or a beach in Florida.
Yep. Right.
Or
a swamp down right below our work.
Yep.
We've been talking about this how long now? An hour? And we still haven't even talked about Bucksaw or Purple Rain.
Well, you just said the word.
I know.
We have to calm the audience down again.
I know. I wasn't going to bring it up, but I will real quick. First, I had to – this might even be before you, Pete, but you would probably be aware of it. So Tom Teasdale, local frame builder in the Iowa City West Branch area.
Tom Teasdale built our first two Muckluck prototypes.
I know that. Do you want to know how I know that?
Rust Flake and Snowflake, we call
them. Snowflake, I know that. Because my friend Steve McGuire, Tom's health was kind of failing him, and Steve was kind of taking care of Tom. And Tom, at that point, was a little bit isolated, we'll just say. And so I got the opportunity to go to Tom's garage with Steve. You know, that was like the only way he got to Tom. And I remember him like, oh, you got to see this. And I've never met him before. And he just like moves all this stuff and he sits this chunk down on the thing. And he's like, you know what that is? And I'm like, it looks like a bottom bracket shell, but I've never seen anything like this. And he's like, yeah, well, I had to cut two and weld them together because this company, I can't tell you who, but they want me to build this, I think they call it a snowflake. I'm not really sure what's going on, but it's going to have big tires. And I'm like, what? Like, what is going on? So I'm looking at a welded in the middle bottom bracket shell that's eventually going in the prototype for the first Muckluck, the Snowflake. He didn't give me enough details to spill the beans, and social media didn't exist back then that I could spill the beans, but was my first experience with Tom and with 100 mil BB shell.
I can't remember. So mine was a medium. Mine was Rust Flake. Snowflake must have been at least a large. It was a larger.
It was from Miser, so it would have been a large.
Yep. And, and we kind of just rode. We were being tasked with hurrying to get that bike done as quick as we could. So it was two steel box, riding them, getting that feedback done as quick as possible so we could get on to having real aluminum ones made.
Yeah, it was just great. Tom, you know, if you ever got the pleasure of know Tom, his reputation and his product precedes him tremendously. You know, one of the, in my opinion, most prolific U.S.-based frame builders in of that genre, you know, sure. Kona, Gary Fisher, all those brands. And just to see him, like, you could see the gears turning of, like, what is going on? This is not what I build, you know, necessarily. I can, but it's not. All right, Pete, you did it. You said it.
Bucksaw.
Full suspension fat bikes, right? So Bucksaw existed 2 years, 3 years, 2 years, 1 year?
3 years.
No, because
I wasn't here, so.
There's at least two carbons, right? A black and a green, and then there was gold and maybe a red aluminum, which made me think 2 years.
Oh, no, even more, I think, because. Okay.
That was longer than that.
Yeah. Well, we had
blue. Teal? There was a teal one, too?
We had aluminum, a blue one, and a gold one. The gold one was carbon. Blue one was aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
There was, at some point, a red one.
Yep.
I think the red one was the first carbon one. The gold and the blue were alloy, weren't they?
Pretty sure they were.
Oh, yeah, you might be right.
Gold was alloy. I remember,
K-Mac showed me the red one. That was the first carbon one.
Yeah, because Tim and I took those blue and gold to Sea Otter.
Yeah, those were aluminum.
Yep.
I just remember when I was at the Interbike Dirt Demo in Vegas the year that it was launched, and I rode it for the first time on dirt, and I was like, this was really fun, but it was so revolutionary at that point.
Right. Yeah. What do you guys think about the fact that, in my opinion, but I think I could base it with facts, much more popular now than when it was on the market? The cult following now... People are really into the Bucksaw. Like,
I don't think Micah and I have read a single social media post where hasn't been a comment about the Bucksaw and Al Mariachi.
Yeah, oh, trust me. I hear it all. We are all in that same boat. But
the most recent comment was, you guys really screwed up when you killed the Bucksaw. Right. That's a quote.
Yeah, right.
And you know what?
Because cut and dry like that, right, Micah? That's, you know,
exactly it.
Absence, you know.
Makes heart grow fonder.
Yeah, like, mm-hmm. It's like, well, where were you that whole year?
Right, who was buying these bikes when they were...
You know, like, we're a business, too. Like, right. We have those issues as well. We have inventory. We have, you know, we have scarcity. We have a glut. And, like, and so, and it's always this classic of, like, we'll have a model, and then we'll have to throw it on closeout, and it'll kind of bleed into the next model year. It might even, like, carry over into the next model year. And then finally it dries up, and then as soon as it dries up, we're like, what?
I was just about to get that one. I've been totally thinking about it. Yeah. I was going to get a Bucksaw.
We've been sitting on them for 12 months. Why?
Right.
You don't notice it till it's gone. But that's good too, because it creates, you know, it creates that demand, and it sometimes you need to step away from it and think about it and chew on it, and then you can come back to it with a fresh eyes rather than just like.
And I will throw this one out there. There's some hardy Bucksaw discussions going on.
Yeah, you said come back. I wasn't going to interpret that in any way, but you said it.
Oh.
No.
I'm telling you, there's plenty of good ideas.
Well, you know, I think that we kind of talked about, like, with regular fat bikes, product availability can make a platform like the Bucksaw more viable, right? Things like carbon wheels, which lighten up the overall load and now can be accessed at more prevalently and at lower costs, won by drivetrains of reduced weight. Suspension forks have come a long way since, you know, like,
free advertisement for Manitou. Like, if you are a fat biker and you're interested in suspension and you haven't tried out that Mastodon fork, you gotta. It's hands down the best fat. Not that there's a lot of fat bike sus forks on the market, but, like, hands down, that Mastodon fork is amazing. They, when they were developing that product, actually came up here and we sat in a room for a whole day and just talked about, you know, what a suspension fork for a fat bike would look like. And I got to say, those guys nailed it. Team nailed it.
Well, to bring it back to the beginning where Micah was talking about niches, we're not always going to make the one thing and continue to make it every year for the foreseeable future. Sure. That would become stale and unexciting.
Right.
Got to keep it exciting.
Right. Keep plugging and playing and plugging and playing. Yeah.
Well, and I'll be honest, and people reading into this, whether the Bucksaw really actually is coming back or not is still up for debate. But there really is conversation here in our group about it. And it isn't about just bringing it back. It's about, well, what's the next one? Like, what's the next version? Because
who says it's a Bucksaw?
Right. It's an interpretation of something that has existed that Salsa produced that you can feed off of, maybe.
What if it's not?
Yeah, and maybe it's not.
What if it's something completely different that you guys aren't even thinking about?
Then I'm going to be super stoked for it. Probably have to add another bike to my quiver because of you, Pete.
Pete's got everybody at the edge of
it. It's always a team effort.
What was cool?
We can edit this all out. The whole Bucksaw conversation just gets erased.
What was cool with Bucksaw was we got those first. So we had
Muckfish before Bucksaw.
Yeah, we had, which was non-split pivot.
Yeah.
Versions and those actually worked. Like, there was enough good stuff from that. I remember you came back from your California trip and you were like, whoa, you'd been riding like the Laguna Hills on his. But then when
I rode a whole enchilada on that bike.
Nice.
The Muckfish was, for people that aren't familiar with that, it was the proto before the Bucksaw was a split pivot bike. Mm-hmm. And we prototyped a full suspension fat bike prior to us moving and partnering with Dave Weigel on split pivot. And it used a Maverick.
SC32.
SC32.
Yep. And Duke 32 I had.
Yeah. And because it was the only fork available.
Right. It's an inverted fork, right?
And we kind of basically took the back end off of our Spearfish at the time. You know, took that, widened it out, and front end. So we kind of affectionately called it the Muckfish because it was a cross up of our current Muckluck and our Spearfish, just as a proof of concept. Uh-huh. We did it as a something for us, but also to, because we knew that if we were going to do what eventually became the Bucksaw, we needed one of the big players to actually make a legitimate fork for it.
Right.
So we're like, we need to proof of concept this and then like get in front of the people, and it turns out RockShox was stepped up to the plate and did the Bluto, but it was that. So that was a really exciting time. And that kind of, that Muckfish just went like directly into the whole split pivot and Dave Weigel thing and suspension bikes. And I remember even when we were first talking to Dave about it, he's like, well, so if we're courting each other, basically, mm-hmm. like, do we want a partner? And he's like, do I get to help design a full suspension fat bike? And we're like, yeah, man. He's
sure.
Like,
I'm in. Yeah, Dave, if that's what you want, buddy, I appreciate your work. Just do what you'd like to
do. And so then, like, now you got Dave Weigel running around the industry, like, we need a full suspension fork. You know, we need a fork on the front. And so, like, that didn't hurt.
That didn't hurt.
Nope.
We're going to take a quick break. I think we're going to bring in another person. We might lose Pete, but Pete, if I lose you in this break, man, that is just gold. Yeah. Pete is gold. I agree. That is
his
just,
hair is also gold and very beautiful.
Oh, luxurious is the word I would use. I just appreciate that. I'm going to get a little more time to express my appreciation to these two, but thank you for that insight. That's really tremendous. Clarifies a lot of things, and hope you don't get in trouble for the Bucksaw stuff.
Not at all.
So we're going to take a break real quick. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to part one of Adam Blake's new podcast with Salsa Cycles. In part two, Adam speaks with Joe Miser, and they talk about gravel, dirty Kanza, and Class 5 VRS.